Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I will be reading you the news headlines from the AP Network Newswire for Tuesday, May 26, 2026. It's the day after the first big holiday of the summer, Memorial Day weekend. If you were in the Massachusetts area, it wasn't the best of weekends, that's for sure. But today is beautiful, tomorrow's supposed to be beautiful, so we'll take it. There's a lot happening in the news, as usual, and we'll jump right in and see how many stories we can catch up on over the next hour. The headline of the first story reads, U.S. military says it carried out self-defense strikes in Iran, including missile launch sites. The U.S. military said Monday that it carried out self-defense strikes in southern Iran, including on missile launch sites and boats placing mines, even as President Donald Trump said on social media that negotiations with Tehran were proceeding nicely. The strikes were done to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces, but the military was using restraint during the ongoing ceasefire, Captain Tim Hawkins, the spokesperson for the U.S. military's Central Command, said in a statement. Further details were not immediately available, including more specifics on the threats from Iran and what this means for negotiations. There was no official response from Iran, which had sent its parliament speaker, Mohammad Baghir Khalabif, to Qatar for negotiations over a possible deal with the United States. Qatar, which faced intense attacks from Iran during the war, holds billions of dollars in frozen Iranian funds. In Iran, the news website Tabnak, believed to be close to former Revolutionary Guard Chief Mohsen Rezai, identified four dead guard troops it said had been killed in American strikes on boats. Iranian state television separately reported blasts around Bandar Abbas, a city on the Strait of Hormuz, home to a military port and a dual-use airport. The strikes were the latest attacks to shake the weeks-long ceasefire in the war. The Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of all crude oil and natural gas traded once passed, remains effectively closed in Iran's chokehold, disrupting global energy markets. Earlier, Trump said any agreement to end the Iran war should include a requirement for several additional countries, including Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, to join the Abraham Accords, the U.S. brokered agreements from Trump's first term aimed at normalizing relations with Israel. The proposal came as the emerging Iran deal faced criticism from fellow Republicans who favor a harder line on Iran, and it could add new diplomatic complications to the negotiations. Trump pointed to Saudi Arabia and Qatar as countries that should immediately sign on. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates became the first countries to join in 2020, diplomatically recognizing Israel. He wrote that after all the work done by the United States to try to pull this very complex puzzle together, it should be mandatory that all of these countries, at a minimum, simultaneously sign onto the Abraham Accords. Trump has long hoped Saudi Arabia would join. Saudi Arabia, in particular, has for decades called on Israel to return to its 1967 borders and allow the formation of a Palestinian nation with East Jerusalem as its capital. Israel's conduct in the war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip has also alienated Gulf Arab states and the wider Muslim world as well. Recognition of a Palestinian state also remains key for Pakistan, which is among the countries that do not have diplomatic relations with Israel. Islamabad-based analyst Syed Mohammed Ali said Pakistan's position on Israel remains unchanged despite Trump's latest proposal. The president said he brought up the Abraham Accord plans with leaders during negotiations on Saturday. He said he would accept one or two countries declining to sign, but said most should be willing. Egypt and Jordan already formally recognize Israel and have long-standing peace treaties. Turkey first recognized Israel in 1949. Masood Khan, the Pakistan's former ambassador to the United States, said it remains to be seen how workable the proposal might be for the countries on Trump's list. The invocation of the Abraham Accords at this stage gives an altogether new dimension to the diplomatic and mediatory processes because this issue is not on the agenda, he said, pointing to the domestic pressure Trump is facing to strike a favorable deal. Still, Khan said, the diplomatic track is still working, and I believe Pakistan is very much at the center of it, supported by regional countries. It remains unclear when or how any deal with Iran might be completed. Trump suggested even Iran could eventually sign on to the accords if an agreement is reached. The accords are a series of diplomatic, economic, and security agreements created with U.S. influence during Trump's first term, which also saw Sudan, Morocco, and more recently Kazakhstan join. So that's a little update on what is happening in the war with Iran, and remains to be seen when a deal will be done, hopefully soon. The next story comes from the education field. The headline reads, America's schools face a backlash on digital devices as screens saturate classrooms. Just a few years ago, America's public schools were rushing to get every child a laptop. Los Angeles middle school teacher Anna Sofa remembers it well. The idea was that technology is the future, so we need to put tech in every child's hands. Now the conversation has flipped. After pouring billions of dollars into laptops, tablets, and learning apps, many schools are facing a digital reckoning. Classrooms have become saturated with screens, and a growing number of parents, teachers, and school districts are saying it's time to scale back. The Chromebook is just a world of distraction, said Sofer, who teaches sixth grade English and history. She favors pen and paper assignments, but is required to use laptops and online apps for certain activities. Every day I'm battling. Who would you rather listen to, Ms. Sofer or Minecraft? The Los Angeles Unified School District, where Sofer teaches, recently became the first major school district to say it will stop giving devices to its youngest students. It is part of a new screen time policy taking effect in the fall across the country's second largest school system. A sweeping resolution passed last month by the Los Angeles School Board requires the district to eliminate devices until second grade, set daily and weekly screen limits for all higher grades, block YouTube on school devices, and ban the use of devices at lunch and recess in elementary and middle school. The district will also audit its education technology contracts, which the teachers' union says amount to $1.6 billion. The Los Angeles crackdown is adding momentum to calls for reform emerging around the country. In many cases, parents lobbied a few years ago for children for school cell phone bans, which have now become the norm. Realizing phones weren't the only classroom distractions, they pivoted to a new target, school-issued devices. The campaign for change is becoming a public policy issue. At least 14 states have proposed laws to limit screen time in schools, according to Ballotopedia. The federal government issued an advisory last week warning that excessive screen use among youth is becoming a growing public health concern. In Los Angeles, concerned parents last year formed a group, Schools Beyond Screens, and pressured the district by speaking out at school board meetings, on social media, and in private talks with administrators. Many are frustrated by trying to curb screen time at home, only to have screens mandated by the school. As a mother of three, Katie Pace does everything in her power to limit screens. There is one family iPad and one television at home, no screen time during the week, and no screens allowed in bedrooms. Her eighth-grade daughter, Clementine, does not have a phone. But as soon as Clementine gets on the Wi-Fi-enabled school bus, her day takes a turn for the digital. For the 30-minute ride to school, Clementine watches YouTube videos on her school Chromebook. In Spanish class, assignments are on the app Duolingo, but many students use Google Translate for answers. Clementine said. Often kids are playing games on their phones, which are supposed to be locked away. In algebra, Clementine writes with her finger on a touchscreen to solve equations. In history, quizzes, tests, and writing assignments are on the computer. Almost all homework is online. Until recently, Clementine would come home and read a book, her mother said, but not anymore. On her daughter's device, History, Pace sees she spends an hour a day streaming music, making Spotify playlists, and watching makeup tutorials and cat videos on YouTube. It makes me furious, said Pace, a member of the school board, School Beyond Screens. My daughter went to middle school and was sent home with a screen addiction in her backpack. A push to put a device in every child's hand and close the digital divide started over a decade ago, but it accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic. Overnight, education shifted online in March 2020. Schools raced to get kids the devices needed to connect to school. When the 2021-2022 school year started, 96% of U.S. public schools reported they had given digital devices to students who needed them, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Many schools switched funding away from textbooks, workbooks, and paper printouts to digital alternatives. Educational technology, or ed tech, exploded into a multi-billion dollar industry. During the pandemic, getting kids devices was a lifetime. Now it's time that we reset, said Nick Melvoin, the LAUSD school board member who drafted the new resolution. Melvoin estimates that few Los Angeles classrooms are using screens effectively in ways that benefit learning. Too often, he said, teachers are replacing instruction with online apps and using screens as a crutch. The challenge, educators say, is that technology has become so entwined with learning, especially for older students, that unplugging from screens at school is complicated. In the affluent Philadelphia suburb of Lower Merion, parents launched a petition campaign for the right to opt their children out of digital devices during school, citing questions about ed tech's benefits. The district had said that opting out is not possible. If there's really no evidence that it helps, and in fact there's no evidence that it's, and in fact there's evidence it's harmful, what are we doing? Test scores are at their lowest point, said Alex Bird Becker, one of the founders of the group PA Unplugged. Other schools are finding that it makes financial sense to stop sending a device home with every child. Fresno United School District, the third largest in California, is spending $4 million a year to replace and repair laptops. Partly to cut costs, the district has told its 40,000 elementary school students to return their take-home laptops and will shift to computer access to inline class only in the fall, said spokesperson A.J. Cato. The Simi Valley Unified School District near Los Angeles stopped sending devices home for its younger students this year, partly because of costly repairs, but also because they were being used for inappropriate Google searches and video games, according to a memo to parents. The district now stores the devices in carts at school. A group of parents in Arlington, Virginia, gathered on a recent Saturday night to share their children's struggles with screen addictions and other side effects of school-issued devices. None of us are Luddites. I know that technology adds value, but I also don't want my son on YouTube all the time, said Lou Ann Oliver, who hosted the group in her living room. Her sixth-grade son struggles to keep track of online assignments and resists the temptation the iPad offers for video games. We get reports on websites he's visited, and he's visiting a game site in nearly every class. The Arlington School District has stopped giving iPads out before first grade and is setting new limits in elementary school, but students in 6th through 12th grades will still be required to have school-issued devices. Another mother, Jenny Sullivan, said she noticed her 4th grade son capitalizing random letters and not getting corrected because there is so little work on paper. She also worries about social implications. Her sixth grader doesn't want to go to the after-school program because everyone is on their iPad. I'd rather be home, he tells his mother. After a three-hour gathering, the parents made a plan to approach the school in the fall with a unified request to opt out of technology and opt in to textbook and paper. 10 years from now, said one of the mothers, Christina Jackson, I can't imagine us looking back with any other reaction other than, how could we have been so naive that we just handed these devices to our kids? It's certainly an issue that parents deal with today with kids and their access to digital information. I'm glad my kids are older and they can deal with that issue with their own kids. Let's see. So the headline of the next story, Cornyn tries to hold on to Texas Senate seat in a runoff with Paxton, the latest test of Trump's power. Texans are choosing a Republican nominee for U.S. Senate in Tuesday's runoff election, bringing to a close the extended, bitter, and expensive primary where President Donald Trump weighed in late to tip the race in another effort to rid the GOP of leaders less devoted to him. Trump's endorsement of State Attorney General Ken Paxton over four-term Senator John Cornyn gives the challenger a late boost and puts Cornyn at risk of becoming the first Republican senator in Texas history to seek the party's nod and lose. That's despite Cornyn's campaign and allied groups spending nearly $90 million in advertising since last year, the vast majority of it attacking Paxton. It's the latest GOP contest where Trump has sought to punish a Republican he sees as insufficiently loyal. This month, he has successfully backed challengers to incumbents in Louisiana, Kentucky, and Indiana, a sign of his enduring influence among primary voters. Paxton's campaign and a pro-Paxton super PAC began airing ads promoting the endorsement within 24 hours of Trump's announcement. Cornyn acknowledged Trump's move would have an impact, but said he wasn't giving up. I know who gets to choose our senators, and it's the people of Texas, he said hours after the endorsement. The winner will run in November against Democratic State Rep. James Tallarico. Tuesday's runoffs also will decide Democratic U.S. House nominees for districts in Dallas and Houston that overwhelmingly support Democrats and a San Antonio area seat the party hopes to flip. Cornyn led Paxton in the March primary, but failed to win a majority in the three-way contest that also included U.S. Representative Wesley Hunt, who finished a distant third. That was after Cornyn's campaign and allied groups waged a month-long campaign, mostly attacking Paxton for ethical and personal questions. The two-term attorney general was acquitted in a 2023 impeachment trial when allegations of extramarital affairs surfaced. Last year, Paxton's wife filed for divorce, citing biblical grounds. The alliance of pro-Cornyn groups have continued its attack, outspending Paxton's campaign and two allied super PACs, $16.5 million to $5.9 million since March 3rd, according to ad tracking firm Ad Impact. Trump promised to endorse immediately after the primary, asking the unchosen candidate to withdraw, but he didn't act until after early voting began on May 18th. Ken Paxton has gone through a lot, in many cases very unfairly, but he is a fighter and he knows how to win, Trump wrote in social media post endorsing him. Our country needs fighters and also loyalty to the cause of greatness. Pro-Cornyn groups lately have been airing ads criticizing the Attorney General Office's handling of a Waco sex abuse case. Pro-Paxton groups had seized on Cornyn's awkward relationship with Trump. The negative tenor could diminish turnout in an election already complicated coming a day after Memorial Day. Texas Republicans, coming a day after Memorial Day. About 2 million of Texas's 18.7 million voters participated in the GOP primary. The dynamic could favor Paxton, whose support draws from more of the most loyal Trump base in Texas, said Norris, who is not affiliated with either campaign. The defining battle lines are based around hyper-negative messaging, which dampens turnout to begin with, he said. So who is going to show up is the hardest of the hardcore. Trump, in his endorsement, also poked at Cornyn, as he has done with other Republicans who are not in lockstep with the president. He blasted Republican Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy as a disloyal disaster on May 16th, before Cassidy lost a GOP primary for the office he has held since 2015. The two-term senator had voted to convict Trump after his 2021 impeachment trial over the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Trump-backed U.S. Representative Julia Letlow, who advanced to a runoff with John Fleming, the state treasurer, Cassidy finished well behind them. Last month, Trump celebrated as Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie, a critic of the Trump administration's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files, lost his primary to Ed Gowrine. Trump called Massie the worst congressman in the history of our country. In endorsing Paxton, Trump said Cornyn was not supportive of me when times were tough and that John was very late in backing me. Cornyn suggested in 2023 that Trump could not win the presidency again in 2024 and that his time had passed him by. He was also an early critic of Trump's plan for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico, a project he now supports. Senate GOP leaders backed Cornyn, saying he would be stronger in the general election. Some GOP strategists have argued a Paxton nomination would cost millions of dollars more to promote in the fall, when money could be spent defending Republican seats in more competitive states. Democrats need a net gain of four seats to take back the majority. Newly elected Representative Christian Menefee and veteran Representative Al Green are vying for the party's nod in Texas's 18th district, which the Republican-led Texas legislature redrew last year to help the GOP. The new map led to a contest between incumbents and marks the end of a dizzying series of elections in the Houston area. Menefee was elected in a special runoff in January to the seat that had been held by the late Representative Sylvester Turner, who died in March of 2025. Menefee finished narrowly ahead of Green in the March 3rd primary, but didn't win a majority to avoid the runoff. Former Representative Colin Allred and U.S. Representative Julie Johnson are competing in the Dallas area 33rd district. Johnson was elected to the seat in 2024, the year Allred lost his U.S. Senate challenge to Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Allred was running for Senate again this cycle, but dropped his bid and instead is looking to return to the House. Near San Antonio, Democratic leaders are trying to prevent Maureen Galindo, who has expressed anti-Semitic views, from winning the party's runoff against Johnny Garcia. While Texas lawmakers redrew the 35th district to help Republicans, Democrats view it as within reach and don't want Galindo's past comments to impede them. That's a little update about it's being Tuesday. There's got to be a primary somewhere, and that is what is going to happen today in Texas. I'll take a look at this story, which is an interesting one. The headline reads, "Releasing cool water protects fish in the Grand Canyon, but that comes at a cost to hydropower." As the Colorado River and its once massive reservoirs shrink from overuse and climate change, officials are faced with a decision that pits conservation against ratepayer costs for electricity. To fight off predators of the humpback chub, a threatened fish native to the river, Glen Canyon Dam in northern Arizona would need to do what is known as a cool mix flow, where cold water is released from deep in its reservoir to cool the river below. But there are no hydropower turbines in the cool deep section, so significant power generation would be lost. The proposal comes after the worst snowpack on record for the Colorado River Basin, relied upon by farmers, industries, wildlife, and more than 40 million people in seven U.S. states, tribal nations, and Mexico. It also comes as those states fail to reach a long-term agreement on how to share the river's dwindling resources beyond this year when the guidelines expire. There's a limited amount of water. It's getting even lower. And with that, a lot of hard decisions need to be made, said John Bergen, the regional policy manager for the environmental nonprofit Western Resource Advocates. Utilities that buy this hydropower say the cool water releases would be costly because they would have to spend millions to buy alternative energy and would increase financial hardship for customers. But supporters say that without cool releases, The warm waters projected downstream this summer would allow non-native predatory fish to spawn, further threatening the humpback chub, and would destroy a world-famous trout fishery nearby. The Bureau of Reclamation, which is expected to announce a decision in the next couple of weeks, said in a statement that it is weighing several factors, including the ecological health of the river and the hydropower production of the dam. The Interior Department, which oversees the Bureau, declined a comment. If the cool water release is approved, it would likely happen from June to October through jet tubes, bypassing the turbines near the warmer surface. Lake Powell, one of two massive reservoirs on the Colorado River, is just 23% full after decades of overuse and evaporation of water as average temperatures rise because of climate change. A record low inflow is expected this summer. With such a low reservoir, warm water near the surface gets sucked through the generators and sent downstream. Smallmouth bass introduced to Lake Powell in the 1980s for sport fishing live at that warm surface and also get sucked through the hydropower generators and into the river below. That's a problem for the humpback chub and other federally protected fish in the Grand Canyon, a 278-mile stretch further south on the river that's world-famous for its geologic formations. A recent study shows that roughly half the bass survive the generators. If the river below is warm enough, they spawn. Smallmouth bass already feast on humpback chub in the river's upper sections, where agencies spend millions of dollars annually to keep the intruders in check. Native fish have been safer below Glen Canyon Dam because it blocks the path to the Grand Canyon, but that may not be true for long. Water temperatures just downstream of the dam are expected to shatter records set in 2022 when smallmouth bass were first found there. Officials project that water will consistently exceed 60 degrees Fahrenheit by mid-June due to the warm water being pulled in from Lake Powell. Anything higher than that and non-native predatory fish that pass through the dam could reproduce. Officials say cool water releases from Lake Powell in 2024 and 25 successfully prevented spawning. It is critical to consider the cost of not doing the cool mix, Heather Whitelaw, the field supervisor with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, said during a recent meeting on managing the issue. We are certainly just giving up on the future for any kind of recovery for humpback chub and all of the other pieces of the system that rely on those cooler water temperatures. With no long-term solution to keep the predators from passing through the dam, withholding cool water would force officials to rely solely on manually removing them downstream. Utilities reliant on hydropower from federal generators are worried. If the cool water releases are approved, it could mean bypassing about half the generation at Glen Canyon Dam, forcing utilities to buy power elsewhere that would likely be more expensive, according to the Utah utility group Heber Light and Power. We keep hearing comments that we must continue cool mix because of the cost of not doing it will be even greater, the Colorado River Energy Distributors Association, which represents about 155 customers who buy federal hydropower generated from the river and opposes the release, said this month in a letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum. We would like to understand what remediation would consistently cost more than $20 to $30 million per year. So, interesting story coming from Colorado, trying to protect a fish from becoming extinct or increasing costs of electricity to the consumers. So it's been some warm weather over in Europe. The headline of this story reads, "Exceptionally early heat wave shatters records and brings deaths to Europe." Temperature records were toppled as a spring heat wave continued to scorch parts of Western Europe on Tuesday, triggering government warnings about risks to life. Several drownings were reported in Britain and France as people tried to cool off. London recorded a rare tropical night, defined as one in which the temperatures not fall below 68 degrees Fahrenheit and Britain's Met Office Weather Service said the temperature in southern England could reach 95 degrees Fahrenheit on Tuesday. Monday was the UK's hottest May Day on record, with the temperature hitting 94.6 degrees Fahrenheit at Kew Gardens in London, smashing the previous record of 91.4 set in 1922 and 1944. Records also fell in France, where temperatures reached 97 degrees on Monday in the country's southwest and widely remained above 68 degrees at night. The National Weather Service, Meteo France, said a heat dome with heat held in place by a high-pressure weather front was producing temperatures more than 10 degrees Celsius above what used to be normal for this time of the year. Unpredictable and extreme weather are becoming more frequent at Earth as Earth's warming builds. Experts say unprecedented and deadly weather extremes that sometimes strike at abnormal times and in unusual places are putting more people in danger. After a long UK weekend that sent people flocking to beaches, pools, and shady parks, London commuters sweltered on Tuesday in subway carriages without air conditioning. Trains to and from the busy Waterloo station were disrupted by a report of smoke on the tracks. In Scotland, firefighters worked through the night to douse a grass fire that sent smoke billowing from Arthur's Seat, the rocky hill that looms over Edinburgh. The UK Health Security Agency issued an amber alert for large parts of the country through Thursday, warning of a potential health risk, particularly among older people, at the hottest times of the day. The UK is used to moderate temperatures, and many homes, schools, and businesses do not have air conditioning. At least three teenagers died in apparent drownings in the UK lakes and reservoirs, and a 60-year-old man died in the sea in southwest England, according to authorities. French government spokesperson Maud Bregon said there have been reports of at least seven deaths potentially related to high temperatures, including five drownings and two deaths in sports competitions. The early heat wave has struck before the annual summer windows, when lifeguards watch over bathers at popular beaches, increasing risks. On France's Atlantic seaboard, where magnificent beaches have powerful riptides, officials reported a rash of emergencies in the surf, with two drowning deaths on Sunday at popular resorts in the Gironde region in the southwest. The top regional administrator, Sophie Brocas, urged beachgoers to exercise the utmost of caution. The unseasonable heat extended to Spain, where Weather Service spokesperson Ruben Del Campo said, "We find ourselves with temperatures we normally see in the middle of the summer, now in the month of May." He said that Seville hit 100 degrees over the weekend, while large parts of the Iberian Peninsula saw temperatures 5 to 10 degrees higher than normal. And in Rome, temperatures were expected to reach 89.6 degrees on Tuesday. So some hot weather in May over in Europe. We had a few hot days, I think it was last week or so. And who knows if it's global climate change or what's going on. Let's see. This headline reads, after a Minnesota church protest, states are toughening penalties for disrupting services. At least four states have adopted laws this year making it a crime to disrupt worship services, a reaction to high-profile protest inside a Minnesota church that prompted outrage from faith leaders. The Republican lawmakers sponsoring most of the legislation say those gathering at sacred sanctuaries deserve protection beyond what existing trespassing laws provide. They also say these new laws will prevent escalating clashes between congregants and protesters, as many churches, mosques, and synagogues remain on edge over recent mass shootings and acts of violence targeting religious groups. People should go to church to be able to sit in peace and worship as they please without having to worry about people coming in and harassing them, said Idaho Senator Mark Harris, a Republican who co-sponsored legislation criminalizing protests inside places of worship. I think the thing that happened in Minnesota was kind of a shock to some of us, that churches would be used as a place to berate people. Critics in both parties have warned that the laws infringe on free speech rights. Bills have been signed into law in Republican-dominated Idaho, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. In Kansas, a bill is becoming law without the signature of Democratic Governor Laura Kelly. Similar bills have been introduced for this year's legislative sessions in at least seven other states and in Congress. Nassau County, New York, passed a similar measure this year. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed a law making it a federal crime to intentionally injure or interfere with or intimidate someone entering a place of worship or a reproductive health facility. The details in the bills differ, but they make it a crime to interfere with religious assemblies. Laws are against trespassing already apply to disruptions on the grounds of churches or other private property. But legislators say the new laws would boost penalties and bar other protest activities like holding signs near places of worship. The penalties could be harsher than for trespassing. In some states, people could face up to a year in prison and fines as high as $10,000 for first offenses. The law also gives the states a way to prosecute cases if local authorities decline to do so. 39 people, including two journalists, were charged in February for roles in a protest during a St. Paul, Minnesota church service. The protesters had learned that one of the church's pastors was also an official at the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement who had been overseeing an intensive Minnesota operation. The U.S. Department of Justice charged the protesters with conspiracy against religious freedom and interfering with the right of religious freedom. The protesters and journalists have pleaded not guilty, and the cases are pending in federal court. Louisiana Representative Gabe Ferment, a Republican, said he was inspired to introduce legislation that allows protesters to be forcibly removed from churches and other places of worship after seeing videos showing the fearful expressions of children at the Minnesota church. "The first thought that came to my mind was those poor kids," Ferment said. "You certainly have a right to protest, but just like you don't have the right to come into someone's home and act like that, you don't have the right to come into a private church property and do that." Oklahoma Senator Todd Gollaher, a Republican, wrote his bill after anti-abortion protesters disrupted his church service last year. His law bars blocking highways within 1 mile of his service or approaching someone to hand them a flyer within 100 feet of a place of worship. His Republican colleague, Senator Kendall Sicari, described the law as extreme and said she was afraid of the precedent it would set. The Nassau County ordinance is already facing a court challenge from the New York Civil Liberties Union, which says there's no history of residents facing intimidation, harassment, or violence outside places of worship, and that the statute denies people their constitutionally protected rights of expression in public places. Kevin Goldberg, the first vice president at Freedom Forum, which advocates for First Amendment rights, said that if the laws are challenged in courts, governments would have to show there's a need for them. "You can't be guessing, you can't be speculating," he said. "There has to be some evidence that there's an actual threat going on, that there's been a problem there, that you can reasonably forecast there will be a problem." In Louisiana, Democrats raised concerns about mandatory jail time for disrupting services and warned that the laws were too arbitrary, suggesting that they could be applied against a congregant for singing out of tune as a pastor delivers a homily. "If the spirit just hits me and I start singing during the middle of his homily, and it disrupts his homily in a way where he's got to say, hey, take a seat, I mean, that would materially disrupt his service, and now I'm going to jail for 30 days? Asked Representative Edmund Jones during a March hearing. The law's proponents said police officers and judges would have discretion about how to apply the law. So, interesting. Here's a story. The headline reads, "Trump's no-bond policy for immigrants in custody played out for years in Tacoma, Washington." Four immigration judges in Washington state were years ahead of a sea change in immigration enforcement that has reversed a long American tradition. The denial of bond for many held on immigration charges, has unleashed tens of thousands of lawsuits since July, alleging violations of constitutional rights against illegal confinement. The Trump administration suffered a legal setback this month when an appeals court knocked down its policy after two other appeals courts had agreed with it, setting up a likely showdown at the Supreme Court. The practice had already played out for years in Tacoma, where immigration judges at the Northwest ICE Processing Center started denying bond early this decade. Few people noticed outside the immigration authorities, attorneys that were there. But when the Trump administration adopted the theory last year, it echoed the judge's reasoning. Neil Floyd, the only one of four Tacoma judges who agreed to talk to the Associated Press, said clerks researched the issues for about 6 months before the judges decided Congress never authorized them to grant bond. "We made the decision that we were going to do it collectively because it was too big a decision for someone to step out that far on their own," said Floyd, who became the top federal prosecutor in Seattle during President Donald Trump's second term. The judges took their cue from a 1996 law that states that applicants for admission to the United States must be detained. The law was long interpreted as affecting people recently crossing the border without legal permission. People living here for years were categorized under a different statute that allowed bond hearings. The Tacoma judges may seem like unlikely figures to spearhead such radical change. While all four, Teresa Scala, the chief Tacoma judge at the time, John O'Dell, Tammy Fitting, and Floyd, started their careers as U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement lawyers, they each granted asylum at rates slightly higher than the national average. Floyd, who left Tacoma after Trump took office last year to advise the FBI on immigration law before moving to his current position, said the judge's conclusion was a matter of fairness based on the law. "It is the right interpretation of the law, and it's the only fair one, because if you enter the United States the right way, by coming and knocking on the door to ask for asylum at a port of entry, the law is 100% clear. And it has been from the beginning that you are detained until we decide whether or not we're going to let you in." Immigration and lawyers in Tacoma were stunned. They scoured the nation for anything similar and found nothing. "It was, from our perspective, a pretty blatantly prosecutorial push to keep people locked up," said Matt Adams, an attorney for the Northwest Immigration Rights Project, which sued over the practice. That case has not yet been scheduled for trial. The lawsuit filed in March 2025 alleges that the Tacoma judges ignored decades of precedent. The Justice Department's Executive Order for Immigration Review, which operates more than 70 immigration courts nationwide, did not respond to requests for comment. So let's see here. What else do we have? California. This is a story from California that you may have heard somewhat on the news. The headline reads, "Evacuation order lifted for some California residents living near a damaged chemical tank." Emergency officials lifted an evacuation order for some of the people who live near a damaged tank containing a hazardous chemical in Southern California after temperatures inside the tank fell enough to eliminate the risk of a catastrophic explosion. However, there's still a chance for a smaller blast or a fire at the GKN Aerospace Transparency Systems plant in Garden Grove near Los Angeles. An evaluation of the tank containing 6,000 to 7,000 gallons of methylmercaptan, which is highly flammable, showed a reduction of pressure inside the tank thanks to a crack that was discovered Sunday. About two-thirds, roughly 34,000 of the evacuated residents can go home as a result. "It's not over yet. We still have work to do," T.J. McGovern, the interim fire chief of the Orange County Fire Authority, said. "We still have to mitigate a fire and a very small explosion concern and also a spill potential." Officials began ordering residents of Garden Grove to evacuate their homes on Thursday after the tank overheated, and by the weekend, about 50,000 residents had been told to leave. Officials said they needed to cool the tank to prevent a toxic leak or explosion. The tank's interior had cooled down to 93 degrees, Covey said on Monday, down from 100 degrees a day earlier. Orange County Health Director Regina Kwong said she wanted to reassure everyone who is returning home that they can feel safe. Exposure to methylmethylacrate can cause serious respiratory problems, neurological problems, and irritation to the skin, eyes, and throat, according to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. There was no contamination. There were no fumes. There were not vapors that came from this incident, she said at a news conference. There was not a leak, so it should be, you should feel comfortable going home, even if you're across the street from that new zero line. The tank might eventually cool enough for crews to safely stabilize and drain the remaining material without triggering a spark or ignition, said Andrew Welton, Purdue University engineering professor who has studied environmental contamination. Welton cautioned there is still... Welton cautioned there is still some risk of an explosion while the chemical inside the tank remains hot and reactive. He said temperatures need to fall closer to ambient levels, roughly 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, before conditions are considered significantly safer. As the interior temperature of the tank increased, methylmethylacrate, which is used to make plastics, converted from liquid to gas, ramping up the pressure and the risk of explosion, Welton said. Some of the methylmethylacrate may already have hardened into a stable plastic, similar to plexiglass, reducing the risk inside the tank, he said. Orange County Supervisor Janet Wynn said the South Coast Air Quality Management District will be monitoring the air for several months, and the EPA will be checking the sewer and storm drains. County health officials have said the chemical is easy to smell, and people may notice it over a large area without being harmed. Authorities have not defined what a catastrophic explosion might mean, but said Monday the worst-case scenario is off the table. Kim Yen, a retiree who had to evacuate her Garden Grove home, said she has been closely following the news and is relieved to learn that the worst has passed. I'm happy, and many of us are happy, but still we are still on our evacuation. Yen, who lives two blocks from the plant, said she's ready to return home, but first wants to be sure it is safe. And she said she's been worried about the emergency crews. They are really our heroes. The parking lot was full Monday at a large park in Fountain Valley, just southwest of Garden Grove, as people sought refuge in an ad hoc shelter there or pitched tents outside. Other people gathered in the park to enjoy Memorial Day. GKN Aerospace Transparency Systems, which owns the plant, is a British company that makes cockpit windows, canopies, and windshields for military and commercial aircraft. GKN Aerospace technical specialists and the Orange County Fire Authority removed external insulation material from the tank to help cool its contents, according to a GKN Aerospace statement issued on Monday. We apologize for the ongoing disruption this incident is causing, and our priority remains its safe resolution so that residents can return to their homes as quickly as possible. GKN Aerospace says on its website that it employs about 16,000 people across 32 manufacturing sites in 12 countries and supplies technologies and components used by major commercial and military aircraft manufacturers worldwide. So there we go. That's a little story about what is happening in California. That situation has really been a little unnerving, certainly especially if you live there. Let's see the next story. The headline reads, "A bystander in serious condition after a fatal shooting near the White House checkpoint." Then the story begins, "A bystander who was struck by gunfire after a man fired on a checkpoint outside the White House and was fatally shot by U.S. Secret Service officers remained in serious but stable condition on Sunday. The Secret Service said the bystander, who has not been identified, suffered a gunshot wound described as non-life-threatening. It was not clear how he was shot. Authorities have released few additional details about the early Saturday evening shooting. The District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department said the suspect, identified as 21-year-old Nasir Best, started shooting toward a White House security checkpoint when Secret Service officers returned the fire. Best of Dundalk, Maryland, was later pronounced dead at a hospital. No officers were injured, Secret Service Director Sean Curran said in a statement posted on social media. Our thoughts are also with the innocent bystander who was wounded during this incident. The Secret Service is hopeful he will make a full recovery. President Donald Trump was in the White House at the time of the shooting. It was the third shooting near the president in past months after a man stormed the White House Correspondents Association's dinner in April, armed with guns and knives, and Secret Service officers were shot and wounded a man who fired at them earlier this month near the Washington Monument. In a Truth Social post, Trump said the suspect in Saturday's shooting had a possible obsession with our country's most cherished structure. He also used the shooting to promote the ballroom he is seeking to build on the site of the White House's former East Wing, saying the shooting goes to show how important it is for all future presidents to get what will be the most safe and secure space of its kind ever built in Washington, D.C. Trump is asking Congress for $1 billion for security additions for the White House campus, including the ballroom. Best had a previous run-in with law enforcement near the White House, according to the District of Columbia court records. He was arrested last July for attempting to enter White House grounds near a different checkpoint. He failed to heed officers' commands to stop, claimed to be Jesus Christ, and said he wanted to be arrested. Best was a track and field athlete at Dundalk High School, from which he graduated in 2023. A woman who identified herself as Best's mother told the Washington Post that she learned about the shooting on social media and was in disbelief. She said her son was never violent, regardless of what people are posting. So that's a little update on that shooting that took place, again, I think it was Saturday night. Let's see what else we can take a look at. Sorry about this, but the story I was just going to go to was a video, and we know that doesn't show too well. So this is a story, the headline which reads, Trump is seeing doctors for his annual physical. What the public finds out is up to him. President Donald Trump is getting a medical exam on Tuesday, putting his health under renewed public scrutiny after he has worked to dismiss concerns over his age and stamina. The 79-year-old president traveled to the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for what the White House described as annual preventive medical and dental checkups. It will be Trump's fourth publicly disclosed medical exam since he returned to office for his second term, and it comes as he tries to project strength ahead of midterm elections that will test his sway with voters. For decades, administrations have released selected results from presidential physicals, offering the public a glimpse at the commander-in-chief's health. But the results are filtered through the White House and must be approved by the president, raising questions about what the public does and doesn't get to see. Trump, a Republican, turns 80 next month and was the oldest person elected U.S. president. His predecessor, President Joe Biden, a Democrat, was 82 when he left office, dropping out of the 2024 presidential race because of widespread concerns he was too old for the job. A Washington Post poll conducted in April found that less than half of U.S. adults think that Trump has the mental sharpness or physical health to serve effectively as president. I think concern for the president's physical health is probably at an all-time high, and I think advanced physical age is the number one concern, said Dr. Jeffrey Kuhlman, who served as a White House physician for more than a decade under Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. For a president of Trump's age, a complete physical would be expected to include advanced heart testing, screening for common cancers, and a cognitive assessment, along with basics like height, weight, and blood pressure. The White House has not disclosed what the visit will entail, but expressed confidence in what it will show. President Trump is the sharpest and most accessible president in American history, who is working nonstop to solve problems and deliver honest promises, and he remains in excellent health, White House spokesperson Davis Ingles said in a statement. In the weeks leading up to his visit, Trump has been saying he feels as good as he did 5 decades ago, even as he jokes about his fondness for fast food and his minimal exercise regimen. Yet he's also sensitive to perceptions about his age, noting that he takes extra caution descending the steps from Air Force One to avoid headlines about a stumble. There is no law requiring presidents to publicize their health records, and the degree of transparency has varied by administration. Trump's past reports have been criticized for offering scant detail and providing statistics that some medical experts eyed with skepticism. At public appearances, Trump is often seen wearing makeup to conceal bruising on his hands, which the White House attributes to handshaking and regular aspirin use. He has sometimes appeared drowsy during meetings and closed eyes for long stretches, although he denies having fallen asleep. Trump often boasts of having aced cognitive tests while frequently deriding Biden, who faced questions about his mental acuity. Biden and his aides push back aggressively against doubts raised about his fitness for the office. Some of Trump's previous physicals have included the Montreal Cognitive Assessment used to screen for dementia and cognitive impairment. His physicians reported a score of 30 out of 30 for Trump at 2018 and 2025 checkups. So we have reached the end of our hour together. I want to thank you for listening to the articles I've selected to read today. I hope you have found them to be both enjoyable and interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.